From WGCU, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. A new study looking at every county in Florida paints a grim picture for women living in the Sunshine State. The Institute for Women's Policy Research says more Florida women live in poverty and lack access to education. But the study also has some good news, especially when it comes to women owning their own businesses. Coming up, we talk with the people behind the study and local people working to help women right here in our area. And a Naples wine expert has joined an elite level of professionals in the world of wine, qualifying as a certified level 3 sommelier. He'll talk about what it took to earn this distinction, and we'll talk about the increasingly influential world of wine in Southwest Florida. Plus, we'll talk with a local wine distributor about what's on trend to serve this holiday season and what wine to watch in 2017. First, the news. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Wine is a big part of the culture and economy of the state of Florida. We rank towards the top when it comes to consumption, and our particular corner of the state is home to some of the highest grossing charity wine events in the world. Southwest Florida is also a haven for wine professionals whose passion really shines. One of those professionals is sommelier Mladen Stoev from Bay Colony, who recently passed the Level 3 sommelier exam, putting him one step away from becoming a master sommelier. It's a big step, but it's one step. There are only 230 master sommeliers in the world, and he joins us in the studio today. Thanks for joining us, Mladen.
Pleasure to be here, Julie.
Also in the studio with us today is Heather Smith from Breakthrough Beverage. She is among the army of people who sell wines to restaurants and stores where we, the consumer, make our selections. Thanks for joining us, Heather.
Thank you for having us.
We are talking about wine with the highest-ranking sommelier in Southwest Florida and with someone who's been working in the industry for years. Do you have any wine questions? Because I'm pretty sure these two could come up with an answer. Give us a call at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Or find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU, using the hashtag GCL. Mladen, first of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
The Court of Master Sommeliers is an international organization which promotes education and excellence in the beverage service industry. And if you work on the service side in a restaurant or in an exclusive club, this is the course of study you pursue. There's a series of tests, level one, level two, and then there's level three, which is a steep departure from the first two. Tell me a little bit about this test that you just took.
The test for the sommelier, it's taking three times annually, and I took... The exam at St. Louis, the venture, it was end of October, and it was quite challenging examination, knowing that the Court of Master Sommelier is one of the highly examinating body in this our industry. And it was challenging to prepare for this exam. You need to take your time and dedication. You need something, got to give. Family and social life needs to give up.
You give up your social life and your family.
Absolutely, in order to prepare it. And examination is actually basically three parts, which you take in three different days.
So it's a three-day exam.
Three-day examination, absolutely. And the first day, you do your service, and everybody who works on the floor knows exactly service is all about your hospitality, your humility. You try to make a perfect pairing for the wines, and that's what they're examining while you opening champagne or decanting wine, and they challenge you the questions, and it's not only about wine. Sometimes you can be asked about sake or beer or any beverage that exists under the sun.
So you walk into a room and you have people pretending to be customers and they just kind of grill you and put
correct,
you through the paces?
You have a master sitting on different stations. One is sparkling wine, which you're opening champagne. And while you're opening that and serving all of those demanding questions being asked, they want to see your grace and hospitality.
That's a big part of it. And then you have a written test?
And then you have a theory, which is very challenging as well. It's, you must know about the entire world of wine and what is really get to play is memorizing the vineyards, the producers. You need to know geology, villages, rivers. So it adds on, and you really need to make this. You take your time.
Yeah, it takes a while. And then you have to do the blind tasting, which is the hardest part, I think, for a lot of people to pass.
It is. Blind tasting sometimes is like a magic, but takes a lot of practices to know the trick. There is something behind it, like a good magic. You need to know what is behind it, and that's what's in a blind tasting. And this happening with a lot of repetition. You really need to, and you cannot do this alone. This is can happen with a group, which I'm very excited about to talk of our community here in town. But examination is three whites, three red wines. you have a 25 minutes and you you're on the clock. You're facing three master sommeliers in front of you, and you have a 4 minutes and 10 seconds to describe each wine precisely with the structure and characteristics. And at the end, you need to make a right conclusion. You need to take the wine home, which is quite challenging for a lot of people. But this is like a learning language. In order to speak a language, you must speak.
So you're looking at a white wine glass. You have no idea what's in it. You have to smell it, look at it, taste it, try it, describe it the whole way through, and then say, I think this is a Chenin Blanc from South Africa or wherever.
Absolutely.
That is so tough. I can't even – every time I try to do that, and I sometimes try, I get it wrong every time, which is why I'm not a sommelier. Heather, the holidays are a really busy time of year, especially in the wine industry, and I appreciate you being able to come in and talk with me today. Tell me a little bit about what's hot for the holidays this year.
I think some of the things that have been hot and is always hot is bubbles. I use the term loosely because I'm getting the most questions and demands for Prosecco, which, being a champagne lover myself, true to the where it started, but Prosecco seems to be what everyone's looking after, along with red blends.
Red blends are very happening.
Red blends are really happening.
And Prosecco is definitely hot.
Mm-hmm.
People are very into Prosecco, which is – just briefly explain to me the difference between Prosecco and champagne for those who don't know.
So I think the simplest way to think about it is champagne actually comes from France, a region within France called Champagne. Prosecco comes from Italy. So here in the community, Lee County, we've got a lot of Italians, and they love their Prosecco, and it's delicious.
And Prosecco is less expensive.
Yes.
Significantly.
Significantly less expensive, and I think something that people are just starting to realize, Prosecco is not sweet. Perhaps 25 years ago, it was a sweeter style. They're beautiful, dry, easy bubbles.
Yeah, for a while there, everything sweet was popular.
I think sweet's always going to be a little on the popular side.
Yeah. Well, I guess we all drink Coca-Cola as teenagers and then grow up and then still drink sweet stuff. And that's where there's a lot of sweetness in red blends these days, too. I'm finding it.
No, I agree with you. I think some of the red blends, they've got a little higher alcohol content and there's a little more extracted fruit, and it's something that people find pleasant. What I think about in the industry in the area, whatever they want to buy is what we're going to sell them.
Yeah, but they have the demand. We are talking about wine with our guest sommelier Mladen Stoev and wine salesperson Heather Smith. What would you like to know about wine? You can become part of the conversation by calling us at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK, or find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media, or on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, for years, the world thought that anything pink was sweet. And I know we're kind of on a sweet kick here, but dry rosé was huge everywhere else. And finally, it seems like Southwest Florida has gotten it. Have you noticed that people have figured out dry rosé?
Absolutely. I think in the hot weather in Florida, rosé is a very good match. In 80 degrees, rosé is perfect for any seafood or even just sipping it as a nice glass of wine.
It's good all the time down here. It should be the official state wine just because of our weather situation, I think.
I couldn't agree more.
For people that are used to seeing anything pink and thinking automatically sweet white Zin, tell me the difference.
Well, this is always people who used to be drink wine Zinfandel, they're looking this for this sweet tone on the white Zinfandel, while classical rosé, which most likely I can say the home of rosé is Provence, which have this nice lean spine of acidity and crispiness, which drives nice floral finish, is something that most likely the new trends look for.
Yeah, so it is not sweet. It's not produced any differently. It's just that Zinfandel tends to have more sugar when it's produced as a rosé.
Correct.
And they don't add sugar to it.
No, they don't.
So dry rosé, usually you're saying Provence?
Provence, absolutely. Provence is the home for me for rosé, and you can find fantastic crispy representative. I don't want to put any producers because I don't want to be heavy on my taste, but this is what I really feel, that nice crispy rosé, which is on the affordability side, is quite good as well.
That's an interesting thing about recommending wines, whether you're recommending to your own taste or recommending to what the person is asking you for. So that's probably one of the nuances of being a sommelier.
Correct. You most likely offer the varietal, the structure of the wine, and you don't really want to lean towards a specific producer or in that case.
Well, we have a question coming in from Lynn down in Naples. She's asking about higher alcohol in red wine. Lynn, do you think you're sensing higher alcohol?
I'm wondering, my brother-in-law said that the higher the alcohol content, the drier the red wine, and wondering if that's true.
All right. What is the relationship to alcohol levels and dryness?
I disagree. Most likely the higher alcohol is coming because of the fruit is getting quite ripe. And the fruit, the more ripe is fruit, there's more sugar in wine. So that's why sometimes you mentioned earlier in the interview, that's why sometimes you taste a little bit of a sweetness on the wine because they have we call 28 bricks. They have a high sugar content, which is still you can taste in the wine. So that's why I believe that the more high alcohol, they have a little bit more touch of sweetness. This happens especially in case of Amarone, but the wine is made from raisins.
In that case, yeah, that for case. Sure. Well, part of the fermentation process is sugar turning into alcohol.
Correct.
So if you have a high alcohol content, I guess logically you would guess that there is going to be less sweetness and less sugar, but sometimes you're starting out with a lot more sugar.
Okay.
And that's what you're talking about with ripe grapes because they have a lot more sugar in them. So if you bring it up to like 16% alcohol, you still have some sugar left over, especially with, you know, those big Zins and stuff. So, okay. Well, we are talking about wine. If you have any questions, give us a call, 1-877-428-8255. We are talking with a sommelier and a wine professional. With the holidays upon us, I wanted to ask you, what do you think would be a good go-to to have on hand for holiday celebrations?
I think a good go-to on hand would be a choice of three because you may have more people coming over than not, and I would actually go for a dry rosé. I would go to a sparkling wine of your choice, whether it be a cava, a prosecco, or a champagne. And then for the holidays, I might actually go with a Pinot Noir, a little more universal, lighter style with this warm air, and it's going to go with a lot of things that people are going to serve.
That's pretty approachable. What do you suggest?
Well, when I'm looking to the holidays, depends. I think most likely it depends what you're cooking for the family. And look, a lot of families, they're just getting together in these moments. They haven't seen each other for probably 2-3 times a year. And that's the time that really family comes together. And you really want to have a fun because the Christmas is all about family meal. Everything's in the middle of the table. And I highly suggest you can do the same with wine. Put everything in the middle. And if you have a nice couple of fish courses, why don't you grab something with good, bright acidity that can really please those good fish you cook for Christmas. Grab some Sauvignon Blanc from the old world, from the new world. Get something good Riesling that really have an expiring acidity. And so play with those nice crispy whites because at the end of the day, everybody puts on their fish a piece of lemon. Fish like acidity, and acidity is what good wine can please every fish. Well, if you do some classical, traditional Merry Christmas duck meal or roasted poultry, that's where your slightly oaky Chardonnay or good Pinot Noir can play the role, or even Beaujolais. Cru Beaujolais is getting very hot these days, so this is something that you may consider.
And people are easily confused by Beaujolais. Would you mind spelling out Beaujolais for me? Because everybody thinks Beaujolais Nouveau.
Well, this is the three categories of Beaujolais. Beaujolais Nouveau is something that French people destroyed. Actually, their image is very fresh wine, which is released the third Thursday of the November. It's very floral, carbonic maceration, very flowery. Very. Then we have a next layer, which is called Beaujolais Village, which get a little bit more serious. Well, Cru Beaujolais, that's what we're looking for, which is still very affordable. And if you make a fantastic turkey or ham or any, and it's very good pleaser of any meal, Cru Beaujolais can be quite value from all of those 10 villages into Beaujolais, grown on Gamay with crispy acidity, very floral, and can please any Christmas table.
So Beaujolais is made from Gamay. Yeah. And when you look at the label, you want to look at something that says Cru on it.
Yes, Cru Beaujolais, can be Morgot, can be Moulin Avant, all of those Cru, 10 Cru Beaujolais, which is spelled on the label, quite affordable, but good value.
I mean, and I think you're talking about, you know, around 20.
20s, yeah. In 20s, you can have a fantastic Cru.
And Cru Beaujolais, that refers to the 10 different crus that are within the Beaujolais region of France, which is south of Burgundy, correct? Just south of Pinot Noir land, which we just talked about, Pinot Noir also being an option. I want to rattle off a few typical dishes that people might have over the holidays and see what you think in rapid-fire succession. Turkey, what do you think, Heather?
Oh, Lord, have mercy. Turkey. I haven't had that in years.
You haven't had turkey yet? Well, that was just a couple weeks ago everybody had turkey.
Turkey, honestly, rapid fire. Sorry to be delayed. I might actually do a Pinot Noir.
Pinot Noir for turkey?
Mm-hmm.
Would you do a white for turkey?
I could do a little bit slightly oaky Chardonnay can please the turkey.
Or a barrel fermented.
Correct.
Kind of one. That would be nice. And then ham. Ham's kind of hard because it's so salty. What would you put with ham?
For him, I would stick more towards a German Riesling, something that was slightly off dry. I think it would balance nicely with the saltiness in the ham, and then if you have it with a little bit of a sweet glaze, I think it would actually complement each other.
It would kind of work together?
Well, let me tell you, sometimes I'm thinking that the real quality of wines lies when you have a little bit of age and very affordable wine with age you can hit on the market. It can be a Rioja for me, like a Tempranillo, which if you buy one good Rioja can be quite affordable and have already 10 years of age behind it, I think can please this ham quite well.
There are some deals coming out of Rioja.
Absolutely.
And that's the Tempranillo grape, and you're saying that might work with some ham?
Absolutely.
Okay, prime rib, when you have a big, huge hunk of beef there, what do you think?
Hey, when you have a protein, you need tannin. So that's where you're looking for your thick skin varietals. Cabernet, Malbec, that's what you need for your primary, that the real marriage comes to play.
And then duck or goose. I don't know if anybody does goose anymore, but the Christmas goose, we've all heard of the Christmas goose, but it's kind of like duck. What do you suggest for those guys? They're kind of fatty.
They are fatty, and there's definitely classic pairings to go with it, but that's where I would actually probably bring in the champagne. I think the champagne goes with almost everything that you can serve anyways, but also the bubbles, perfect with that fattiness in the duck.
I have to agree with champagne with everything, for sure. What do you think with duck?
Well, for duck, I'll put some good Burgundy. This is the time when you have your family together. Reach out to your wine cooler and cellar, get something good, because at the end of the day, 10 years from now, your family will remember the good meal, the good moments, the laughter, and the bottle of wine you open.
Yeah, especially when it goes really well. And then with lamb, what if you're doing lamb? Not with the mint, but, you know, lamb with garlic and rosemary, like a chop. What do you think?
I personally would stick with something red, but a little bit on the softer style of red. I might actually go with really just a beautiful Merlot.
Oh, yeah. Merlot's so user-friendly. Mm-hmm. It's pretty easy. What do you think?
Well, I'll get something more tannic as well. A lime is good structure. I'm going to take this dish to Piedmont, and I can go for a fantastic Barolo or Barbaresco.
And a fair warning, if you get Barolo, make sure it's an older one. You don't want to get a young Barolo because that'll just take the enamel right off your teeth. We have a call coming in from Kristen in Fort Myers. What would you like to ask?
Hi. I am curious what you both think. For someone who's looking to branch out and try new wines, something that's maybe not so mainstream that would be a new, interesting wine to try.
Well, what would
that's
you,
affordable.
What do you usually like?
Usually I stick to Pinot Noir or Pinot Grigio.
Okay. So you have the Pinot family. Where do you go from there? What would you suggest?
If you're looking for something really excited, the new trendy area that you can reach out if you really enjoy Pinot Grigio, I can suggest definitely Etna. Sicily in Italy is getting very exciting, and that's growing on a nice volcanic area, extreme weather where the grape is Cataratto. So Etna Bianco is something that really crispy, sometimes in the same price range as a Pinot Grigio, so I think it can be perfect fit.
So you're looking for something from Sicily, from the region of Etna?
Etna, correct.
And the name of the grape was Cataratto?
Caricante is the grape. Caricante or Cataratto, they mix them both. Great.
They're usually a blend. So you're probably not going to see the name of the grape on there?
Correct.
So just look for Etna.
Etna Bianco.
Etna Bianco. So there's one to check out. And the island wines, I think, are still fairly reasonable.
Absolutely.
The ones from the Italian islands. And they're very much on trend, too. So you'll probably look cool when you show up. Heather, what would you suggest as an alternative to Pinot Noir? She said she usually likes Pinot Noir.
Mm-hmm. As an alternative, I'm going to go with something that I've actually been enjoying lately and seeing a little bit more of is Grenache, or it would be Garnacha in Spain. I think that's something that's great. It's not new, but you don't see it very much, and it's just it's a nice segue into something. I also think it's going to be the new hot wine.
You think that's going to be cool?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's also very affordable.
Very affordable, and it can also be extremely amazing. It could be like the wine I had last night, and a shot enough to pop.
Yeah, that is, and that's another big place where it comes from. And then on Twitter, we have a tweet coming in asking, is sherry on a comeback? Have you seen any of this? Dry sherry?
I've
sipping
seen it.
Sherry?
I've seen people asking for it, kind of reaching into it. I think it's for the people that are just looking for something fun and unusual and to play with.
Something a little different?
Mm-hmm.
I've had a friend that was really into it with oysters. Dry sherry with oysters.
Correct. Pinot can be a very good partner because he has this still nice chalky minerality that we usually look for oysters to be paired with. But unfortunately, sherry lost a lot of its market almost in half compared to the 10 years ago. And most of the market was driven by the British. But slowly, actually, our sommelier things to put in our programs to really show this is a very unique beverage established for a long time ago, which really deserves a place in our tables.
Well, there's so much wine out there. It's kind of hard to find room for everybody, you know. And, boy, if you try everything that goes with every bite you have, it's going to be a long night. I wanted to ask for Hanukkah. I know there are kosher wines out there. Do you know anything about the difference in the production of kosher wines versus regular wines?
I don't know much about kosher wines, but in fact, Israeli wine is getting also another hot spot. I'm amazed that the Gerson Foundation organizes now enrichment trips to Israeli wines because the area is getting really, really excited. And especially in the Israel is one of the most southern growing area in the northern hemisphere. But when they're losing latitude, they're gaining altitude, which remains quite crispiness in their wines. And especially in the area where Galilee, one of the growing region over there, they have a quite excitement. Cabernet Sauvignon Blanc and Chardonnay thrives. Back to your kosher questions, is there is not much restriction who is tending the wine in the vineyard. The real restriction begins when the wine is get crushed, which we need to have something special due to observe the procedure till the wine is pasteurized or bottled, whatever whichever comes first. And of course, there is a couple of very great estates. Early ages, in the mid-50s, most of the kosher wine was sweet and most likely exported to the, all of those Jewish communities.
Oh, the Manischewitz.
Correct.
Yes, the Manischewitz. But I think that's because maybe they didn't have as good control on the pasteurization part of the process, so then they would add sugar or sweeten it up so that it was palatable. Because pasteurizing is kind of tricky when dealing with wine because temperature is pretty important.
Correct. But however, I think they're moving now to the dry style, and we have a couple of beautiful estates which most likely export all of those kosher wines, like Golan Heights and Carmel, which make one of the first wineries. They make fantastic kosher wines to please Jewish communities around their holidays.
Before we go, we're kind of getting down on time, but I did want to ask you a little bit about bubbles. What is the difference? What is Méthode Champenoise versus all the other? And okay, first of all, what does Méthode Champenoise mean? And what other wines are made in the same way as Champagne but are not actually from Champagne? That's a tough one.
It's a tough one, and I think, you know, with the traditional way, it's the way it started in Champagne, and the process is actually – it's a double fermentation within the bottle itself.
And that's what produces the bubbles.
Yes. And so it does take a little longer. It's a little more expensive. I mean, and with it, there's also rules with which particular grapes can be in it and used, along with the actual where they specifically come from.
And that's in Champagne.
In Champagne.
But then there are other places in France that make Cremant de wherever, Cremant d'Alsace, Cremant de Bourgogne, even Cremant de Bordeaux, which I actually heard of recently. It's kind of new. And they're really trying to market it. But they're also, if it's called Cremant de, I think that means it also has to be Méthode Champenoise. So it also has to have that secondary fermentation in the bottle.
Correct.
If you find something that's not from Champagne but labeled Champagne, is it Champagne?
No, it is not Champagne. Majority of areas do adhere to not putting Champagne on the label if it's not from the region of Champagne. There are a few areas that will still do it, despite because it's not illegal, and generally they use a small C.
It's kind of an honor system kind of thing, and people are just maybe not honoring it.
Yeah, to use it loosely.
And then there's Franciacorta, which is a Méthode Champenoise wine, secondary fermentation. Tell me a little about that.
Well, this is a fantastic area in Lombardia. It's around the city of Milan, and Franciacorta is doing a fantastic job. In fact, they're using almost the same grape as the Champagne, Pinot Noir, Pinot Nero, Pinot Blanco. And they have an even more strict time to lay the wine down even longer than Champagne does. And that's what brings, it's called autolysis, which really brings those secondary fermentation of bourbon, this style of yeasty, yogurty, doughy style Champagne, which really shows compared to, of course, Prosecco, which is you don't take it very seriously. It's floral and peach and take it easy, chill it and have a good time.
And Prosecco is different because it's tank fermented.
Correct.
Which is called Charmant, I believe. We have to leave it there today, but I wanted to thank you both for coming in. Mladen Stoev, Level 3 Sommelier from Bay Colony, congratulations once again. And Heather Smith from Breakthrough Beverages, thank you for coming in. And cheers. Our show today was produced by Matthew Smith and directed by Richard Chin Kui, with technical help from A.J. Leonard. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. Next week on Gulf Coast Live, we are rebroadcasting some of our favorite shows from 2016. You'll hear episodes ranging from shark research to seminal patchwork, plus an interview by our Amy Tardiff of Gene Wilder, who passed this year. We'll be back in January with more Gulf Coast Live every weekday at 1 right here on WGCU. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO, Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.